Good morning. Good morning. I'm Norma Bufford, and I have the privilege of teaching you today about our 19th woman of the New Testament, Salome. Will you join me in prayer? Lord, thank you for your precious word, and thank you for our study this year of these New Testament women. Help us to examine our own lives as you reveal to us lessons from their lives. And help me today to share with these women the truths you've been teaching me from the life of Salome. Amen. Well, before we dive into the scriptures, I'm going to tell you a little bit about myself. I'm married, and I have three young adult daughters who are 21, 23, and 25. People who know me well would probably tell you that I like numbers and spreadsheets and math, and that is totally true. And I've passed that love of math on to my darling daughters, two of whom are math majors, and the other one is studying to be a research scientist and uses lots of statistics. But I also love to read, and I raised my three girls to be avid readers, too. I started reading to them when they were just babies, and we continued reading together till they were well into middle school. We started with board books, and then we moved on to picture books, and then we plunged into some of those children's classics like the Mary Poppins books and the Little House on the Prairie books and the Oz books and many more. And part of the fun of reading to my girls was introducing them to books and authors that were favorites of mine when I was a child. And one of my favorite childhood authors was Dr. Seuss. As a child, I loved his wacky characters and his creative rhymes. And then as a parent, I still loved his wacky characters and his creative rhymes. But I also loved the humorous way that he incorporated moral messages into his stories. And as I prepared for this lecture, a particular Dr. Seuss story kept coming to my mind. It's titled Yertle the Turtle. Any of you familiar with this story? It's about two turtles, one named Yertle and one named Mac, and it starts off in the turtle pond where Yertle is the king and life is good. A nice little pond. It was clean, it was neat. The water was warm, there was plenty to eat. The turtles had everything turtles might need, and they were all happy, quite happy indeed. Well, all the turtles were happy until Yertle, the turtle king, decided that he wanted more. He wanted more prestige. He wanted more authority. He wanted a higher rank. And Yertle's strategy to raise his rank was to make his throne taller. This throne that I sit on is too low down. It ought to be higher, he said with a frown. If I could sit higher, how much greater I'd be. What a king. I'd be ruler of all I could see. So Yertle the turtle orders the other turtles to climb up on his little throne and stand on each other's back to make the throne higher. He piles them up, and then he sits on them, and he gloats about his newfound status. I'm Yertle the turtle, oh marvelous me, for I am the ruler of all that I see. But as you can imagine, while Yertle was enjoying the view from the top, the other turtles were not quite so happy. In fact, the other turtles were in pain, especially the turtles at the bottom of the stack. And the turtle at the very bottom of the stack was a plain little turtle named Mac. There he is at the bottom. As the story continues, Yertle keeps on demanding more and more and more turtles to climb onto his throne to make it higher and higher and higher. And he keeps on congratulating himself. I'm Yertle the turtle, oh marvelous me, for I am the ruler of all that I see. Finally, little Mac at the bottom speaks up. Mac says, Your Majesty, please. I don't like to complain, but down here below we are feeling great pain. I know up on top you are seeing great sights, but down at the bottom we too should have rights. We turtles can't stand it. Our shells will all crack. Besides, we need food. We are starving, groaned Mac. But Yertle the turtle had let his high position feed his pride. And so instead of showing concern for Mac and the other turtles, Yertle rebukes Mac for even questioning him. Yertle says to Mac, "You hush up your mouth," howled the mighty King Yertle. "You've no right to talk to the world's highest turtle. I rule from the clouds over land, over sea. There's nothing, no nothing, that's higher than me." Yertle basically defends his ill treatment of the other turtles by pointing to his lofty position as just sitting there high on a throne gave him permission to abuse those down below him. Well, we've all heard the saying, pride goes before a fall, and in true Dr. Seuss fashion, the story ends with Yertle literally falling from his throne and ending up in the pond with a face full of mud. And today, the great Yertle, that marvelous he, is king of the mud. That is all he can see. So why have I told you this story about turtles and thrones and pride? Well, because we live in a culture that is dominated by Yertle-like thinking. We think that greatness comes from having a prestigious job title or fame or just the authority to tell other people what to do. But Jesus taught us a very different standard of greatness, a standard of greatness that isn't based on how high your position is. Jesus taught us that we should embrace a version of the Mac-like thinking instead of the Yertle-like thinking. Today we're going to look at a mom who had some decidedly Yertle-like ambitions for her two sons. Her name was Salome. She was the wife of Zebedee and the mother of James and John, who were two of Jesus' 12 disciples. Let's unveil the mummy. Which is tricky when you're only 5'2". Okay. So she's wearing green because I thought that would be a nice turtle color. And she has her own copy of Yertle the Turtle. And she has this little wooden turtle that kind of reminds me of Mac because his shell is flat from being stood on. Salome is going to teach us the dance of kingdom greatness, a dance that she learned straight from the best dance teacher ever, Jesus himself. And there's two steps to the dance of kingdom greatness. Before I show you the steps, I'm going to show you two words in American Sign Language. The first sign is forget. It's kind of like you're just wiping a thought out of your head, forget. And the other sign is serve. It's kind of like you're holding a tray and serving someone. So our dance of kingdom greatness uses those two signs. The first is to forget prestige and to serve others. Forget prestige, serve others. That's the dance of kingdom greatness. It's the dance that Salome learned, and it's the dance that we can learn too by letting the truths of this passage soak into our hearts. But Satan doesn't want us to learn that dance of kingdom greatness. Satan wants us to practice his two-step dance, that is, doubt his word and distrust his goodness. Doubt his word and distrust his goodness. Satan wants us to doubt Jesus' teaching and to just keep on thinking like Yertle the Turtle. But my hope is that we'll walk out of here with a view of greatness that's based on what Jesus teaches rather than what the world teaches. I've divided our passage into three divisions. You can see them on your outline. The first is prestige and power, Matthew 20, verses 20 to 24. Then servant and slave, Matthew 20, verses 25 to 28. And then grief and good news, Matthew 27, verses 55 to 56, and Mark 16, verses 1 through 7. Before we start reading, I'll give you a little background to the encounter that we'll read about. Salome's sons, James and John, were part of Jesus' inner circle of followers. And Salome was one of the women who followed Jesus from Galilee and took care of his physical needs during his years of ministry. This passage takes place near the end of Jesus' life, so Salome would have known Jesus for about 3 years, and she would have heard much of Jesus' teachings. In this passage, Jesus and his followers were on their way to Jerusalem. Jerusalem, where Jesus' earthly ministry would end. Jerusalem, where Jesus would fulfill his purpose as the Lamb of God sacrificed for our sins. Jerusalem, where Jesus knew he would soon die. As they were approaching Jerusalem, Jesus was intent on teaching his followers about his coming death. But they didn't get it. his followers, including Salome, were expecting something quite different to happen in Jerusalem. Like most Jews at the time, they expected the Messiah to kick out the Romans and establish an earthly kingdom. They wanted their Messiah to rule on earth like King David. And they were hoping that Jesus would set up his earthly kingdom when they got to Jerusalem. And Salome knew that a king doesn't rule all by himself. A king needs advisors and governors to help him, some prestigious positions that Jesus would need to fill if he was going to be ruling an earthly kingdom. So with this background in mind, let's dig into our first division, prestige and power. We'll start reading in Matthew 20, verse 20. Then the mother of Zebedee's sons came to Jesus with her sons and, kneeling down, asked a favor of him. "What is it you want?" he asked. She said, "Grant that one of these two sons of mine may sit at your right and the other at your left in your kingdom." So how did Salome come to Jesus? Was she bossy? Was she demanding? If we look at verse 20, it says that she kneeled in front of Jesus, which was a sign of respect, but she was asking for special favors. Her motivation actually seems pretty selfish. But regardless of Salome's motivation, Jesus engaged with her. He didn't turn her away. Jesus focused his attention on her, and he listened. Do you know that Jesus listens to you when you come to him? Even if your motivations aren't 100% pure, Jesus cares about what you care about, and he wants you to come to him, and he listens. So what did the kneeling Salome ask? Well, she asked for her two boys to be the top bananas in Jesus' new kingdom. They'd been following Jesus around for several years now, and now she's ready for her boys to settle down into some nice, well-paying jobs with lots of authority. Have you ever seen an org chart? An org chart is a picture of a company or organization, and the boxes represent people and their jobs, like this. On a typical org chart, the people at the top of the chart are the ones with the most prestigious jobs. These top-of-the-chart folks, they take on great responsibility. They make most of the decisions, and everyone else is usually striving to move up the org chart, hoping to be one of the top-of-the-chart folks someday, just like our friend Yertle the Turtle. The people at the top of the org chart are the superstars, and the people at the bottom of the org chart are not. The bottom-of-the-chart folks are often overlooked and undervalued, like Little Mac. Well, Salome had an org chart in her mind for Jesus' kingdom when she made her request. On Salome's mental org chart, Jesus was at the top, and she was lobbying for her two boys to be in those two boxes just under him. Salome was taking what she knew about earthly greatness and just trying to fit that into God's realm. She was trying to ensure that her sons would get their fair share of greatness in Jesus' kingdom. Have you ever had those kind of ambitious desires, like Salome, for yourself or your loved ones? As a parent, have you ever tried to live out your dreams through your children? I know that I have. When my girls were younger, I had all kinds of dreams for them. Over the years, I hoped and prayed for them to be given prestigious positions, like being admitted to an elite academic program or earning a spot in the championship gymnastics meet or being chosen to sing a solo part in the choir. Just like Salome was asking Jesus for what she thought was best for her boys, I just wanted what I thought was best for my girls, which was a chance to show the world how wonderful they really are. Are these desires wrong? Or is it only wrong if I'm pushy and I step on others along the way like Yertle the Turtle? Or is it only selfish ambition if I'm pushing for secular fame and fortune? What about if I push for my child to be selected for an internship with a church or a missions organization? Is that selfish ambition too? Let's see how Jesus responds to Salome and her sons, starting in verse 22. "You don't know what you are asking," Jesus said to them. "Can you drink the cup I'm going to drink?" "We can," they answered. Well, first off, Jesus doesn't demean Salome or scold her for her request. He simply points out her limited viewpoint, her ignorance, that she doesn't really understand what she's asking. And then Jesus asks them if they're ready to drink from his cup. And they don't seem to grasp the significance of that question. Their quick response of, "We can," seems to show that they're expecting a cup of glory to be coming their way, when it's really a cup of suffering that Jesus is referring to. Jesus is telling both Salome and her sons that there is a cost that comes with being a follower of Jesus. Are you ready to bear the cost of being a follower of Jesus? Your cost isn't likely to be suffering a tortured death on the cross like Jesus, and your cost isn't likely to be banishment from your community like that blind man in last week's passage who was put out of the temple for proclaiming Jesus in front of the Pharisees. Your cost might be something more like losing a friend when you politely decline to attend their gay wedding. Your cost might be losing out on a promotion at work because you're seen as too much of a goody-goody. And have you ever considered that there's also a cost to achieving worldly success and rank? The cost of losing sight of Jesus because you're so distracted by the prizes that the world dangles in front of you? Or the cost of being insensitive to injustice because your success leaves you isolated from people in need? Do you take these costs into consideration when you have ambitious dreams for yourself or your family? Let's go on to verse 23. Jesus said to them, "You will indeed drink from my cup, but to sit at my right or left is not for me to grant. These places belong to those for whom they have been prepared by my Father." Jesus affirms that they will indeed share in his cup, the cup of suffering. And we know from later scriptures that James was the first apostle to die, and he died a martyr. And John was exiled to the island of Patmos for his teaching about Jesus. What I find so precious about this whole conversation with Jesus and Salome and her sons is how gently Jesus treats them. Jesus listens to Salome, even though she's motivated by selfish ambition, even though they don't understand what they're asking for. He listens to their requests, and then he asks them a question that's designed to get them to think. He takes time to teach them about the cost of being his follower and the authority of God the Father. And that's what prayer is about. Jesus wants us to come to him just like Salome did, not just so we can tell him what we want, but so that he can talk to us, to ask us probing questions, to get to the heart of things, and to teach us more about himself, about the one true God. Prayer is a conversation between Jesus and us. Well, Salome wants her will to be done, but Jesus answers her request by telling her that the Father will choose who will be honored. Basically, Jesus says no to her request. How well do you listen when God answers no to your prayers? Do you really listen? Do you listen with a teachable heart? Are you ready to accept his no or his not now answer and continue to believe? Or do his answers of no send you off to start practicing Satan's two-step, to doubt his word and to distrust his goodness? Well, let's see what happens next with Salome. When Jesus says no to her request, does the situation simply fade away? Not exactly. Look at verse 24. When the 10 heard about this, they were indignant with the two brothers. Well, seems like the rest of the disciples must have overheard that conversation, and basically, they were ticked off. That's one of those ugly consequences of our self-serving ambitions. There's often a negative ripple effect when we're only seeking honor for ourselves rather than seeking to bring honor to God. As a parent, we might think that we're not doing any harm by asking a favor of our child's coach or teacher. We just want to nudge that coach into giving our child what they deserve by saying something like, "She's such a hard worker, she'd be a great team captain." But what we're also implying when we lobby for our child to be given an exclusive honor is that my child is better than those children, and I know better than that coach or teacher or whoever's in charge. Is it any surprise that there's collateral damage? Is it any surprise that the other disciples were angry over Saloma's request, even though Jesus said no? But the story doesn't end there. In the next passage, we'll see that Jesus takes this opportunity when the disciples are all worked up about Saloma's request to teach them all a lesson on true kingdom greatness. Jesus turns the conflict into a teachable moment. Saloma was pushing for prestige for her sons. Even though she knelt before Jesus, she was pushing for her will. She wasn't seeking God's will. She was acting like a yertle. And that was a misstep. She was marching to her own drummer rather than trying to keep in step with the dances that Jesus had been teaching for the last 3 years. Which leads me to our first truth. God can use my missteps to teach me his steps. God can use my missteps to teach me his steps. So where are you prone to the misstep of coveting greatness for yourself or for your loved ones? Do you find yourself constantly strategizing about how you can move up the corporate ladder or how your child can make it onto that prestigious team or into that prestigious school? Are you counting the cost that might come with those positions? And are you anticipating the ripple effect of jealousy or tension that might be tied to seeking a higher position? Well, Jesus used the conflict that was started by Saloma's request to teach the disciples an important lesson. And Saloma listened to that lesson, as we'll see in the next part of the passage. So let's go on to the next division, servant and slave. We're reading in Matthew 20, verse 25. Jesus called them all together and said, "You know that the rulers of the Gentiles lord it over them, and their high officials exercise authority over them. Not so with you." This is where Jesus begins to teach the dance of kingdom greatness, and like any good teacher, he teaches the first step first, which is forget prestige. Jesus gathers his followers together and tells them to steer clear of the leadership styles that they see around them. No lording it over others. No using their positions of authority as an excuse to treat others poorly. Basically, don't be a yertle. Jesus warns his disciples about not falling into that lorded over leadership pitfall because it's so easy to get caught up in that kind of thinking, even for followers of Christ. I heard this quote in the sermon this past Sunday that describes this yertle-like thinking among Christians. How sadly easy it is to make the very service God entrusts us with into a pedestal on which to display ourselves. So what does lorded over leadership look like in the organizations that we're part of, in our churches, at our jobs, in volunteer organizations? Well, a lorded over leader doesn't solicit ideas and feedback from people who are below them on their org chart. They only want input from people who are above or equal to them in the hierarchy. A lorded over leader values the work that people produce, but they don't really value the people themselves. They don't take time to get to know their fellow team members. Instead, they treat people like easily replaceable cogs in the organization's machinery. A lorded over leader just wants to keep coming up with the next big ideas, but doesn't care much about the effort or the human cost of implementing those ideas. They want to plan and then delegate, leaving the hard work of implementing the ideas to the little people at the bottom of the chart. Do any of these descriptions fit leaders that you know? Do any of these descriptions fit you? Where do you have a tendency to use your role or position to lord it over others? Do you treat people that you work with like machines? You're only interested in what they can do for you. What about closer to home? I'm going to tell you one of my own yertle stories. My three daughters and I, we like to bake, and making cookies is one of our favorite family activities. So two Christmases ago, I decided that we would bake up a whole bunch of cookies and mail them off to all our relatives. I picked out some recipes, I bought some ingredients, I got boxes for mailing. And then, when my girls came home for the Christmas holiday, I went off to work, and I told them on the way out the door that I wanted them to bake up dozens and dozens of cookies for this family project. And when I got home, I was so disappointed that they hadn't done any baking. But the next day, I did the same thing, and the next. And after several days, I was pretty ticked off that they weren't doing the baking that I wanted to get done. And then they were getting ticked off that I was getting ticked off, and it wasn't exactly the happy family activity that I had hoped for. It took my eldest daughter to remind me that I was acting like a yertle. I was being a lorded over them mother. I hadn't involved them in deciding whether or not to tackle this mass baking project. I hadn't involved them in the planning and prep. I hadn't asked them to join in. I just told them to do it. I wanted them to get the job done while I was off doing something else. Not one of my finer moments. So, this past Christmas, as I was preparing to teach this lesson, I decided to try the same Christmas baking activity again, this time trying to steer clear of my yertle-like thinking. So this year, I got my girls involved from the start, baking up samples of some new recipes and doing taste tests to choose the ones that we would make. This year, I asked them if they'd like to help rather than trying to force them. And this year, with the yertle banished from our house, we had fun. I was able to really enjoy all the different ways that they joined in some baking and some decorating and packing up the cookies. I bet you can think of your own yertle stories. And the reason you can probably think of your own yertle stories is that the sin of pride is difficult to eradicate from our hearts. And having authority over others, whether it's in a job or in your home, can be like spreading fertilizer on those little sprouts of pride. And if we're not careful to keep asking Jesus to yank out those pride weeds, we can end up like Yertle the Turtle, demanding our own way and stepping on all the turtles who are supporting us and thinking that we're entitled to that lovely view from the top. Jesus was well aware of this. He first pointed out to his followers what not to do. Don't lord it over others. Forget prestige. Forget about focusing all your time and energy trying to be a top-of-the-chart superstar. That was the first step of the Dansom Kingdom greatness. Then Jesus taught them the second step, serve others. Let's read in verse 26. Instead, whoever wants to become great among you must be your servant, and whoever wants to be first must be your slave. Whoa. Jesus introduced a radical change in the definition of greatness. He tipped the org chart sideways, putting everyone on the same level. He said that greatness doesn't come from having a high position, not from having a fancy job title, not from having a lot of people underneath you on the org chart, not from having a role that puts you in the spotlight like I am up here today. He said, none of this matters. Greatness comes from serving others. You can tell I like. There you go. I like visual aids. Jesus equated greatness with the most humble positions in society, the servant and the slave. To me, that sounds a lot like Little Mac in the Dr. Seuss story. Plain Little Mac at the bottom of the stack, quietly doing his job, quietly serving. Mac, the overlooked, undervalued servant, is the hero of Dr. Seuss's story. And I think Jesus would have liked Mac. So what does serving look like outside of the turtle pond? Well, Jesus is calling us to a kind of sacrificial service that stretches us out of our comfort zone. Jesus calls us to serve those who are hard to love, that difficult coworker who's constantly complaining, that relative that drives you crazy, those people who make you just feel awkward because they're just so different from you. And Jesus calls us to serve in places where no one thanks you, like at home, where it seems like you're always cleaning up other people's messes, or in that volunteer role where no one really appreciates just how much work it actually takes to get the job done, or with your teenage children who just want you to be their chauffeur. Jesus calls us to serve when it's hard, when it's tiring, when it's boring, when it takes you away from other things you'd like to do. Jesus says, this is kingdom greatness, serving others. And Jesus sees what you are doing for his sake, even if no one else does. And sacrificial service, it isn't always painful. Sometimes it's really fun. You might find yourself called to be serving in your areas of giftedness, like I did as a Girl Scout troop leader for 16 years. I loved it, and I had the pleasure of watching these girls in my care learn to really enjoy serving in the community. With my scouts, we stood in the dark passing out cookies and juice to people who were waiting in line at a food bank for their holiday groceries. We spent hours and hours and hours and hours sewing quilts for children in hospitals. We got up in the wee hours of the morning to pass out water to runners in a charity race up at Coyote Point. We spent many hours across many years in cold warehouses sorting canned foods and Christmas toys for various holiday giveaway programs. We served in many, many different ways. It was a sacrifice of time and money, and it took us away from other things. But it brought us so much satisfaction. In fact, every year I'd ask the girls what their favorite activities had been that year. And while they enjoyed the crafts and the field trips and stuff, what they often said were the best things they'd done as scouts were our service projects. Jesus calls us to serve others when it's just plain hard and when it's just plain fun. He says, just serve others. Well, Jesus wraps up his teaching on how to be great in God's kingdom with one more illustration. First, he tells them that they must become servants. Then he tells them they must become slaves. And then he throws out the ultimate example of sacrificial service. Verse 28. Just as the Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus presents himself as our role model. He is our standard. Jesus willingly left the glory of heaven to put on human flesh. That in itself, for God to become man, was a huge sacrifice. And then Jesus did even more. While he lived on earth, he served those around him. He healed and he taught, even when he was tired, even when he was being persecuted. He revealed his true identity as Messiah to an outcast, immoral woman at a well. He protected a woman caught in adultery from being stoned. And he listened to Salome when she came to him with ambitious, self-serving plans for her sons. And then he gave up his life for all of these sinners, for you and me. The Son of Man did not come to be served, but to serve and to give his life as a ransom for many. Jesus' dance of kingdom greatness is so different from the world's dance of greatness. We think that greatness comes from hierarchy, from being at the top of the biggest throne or from having the highest rank on the org chart. But Jesus taught that greatness comes not from hierarchy, but from humility. And Jesus' most powerful teaching about humility came not from his words, but from his death, from his crucifixion. A couple of months ago, I heard a talk by a Christian speaker named John Dixon. Dixon is a pastor, a musician, and a professor of ancient history. His talk was about humility. Dixon defined humility as the noble choice to forgo your status and use your influence for the betterment of others. And I put that definition on the bottom of your handout. Today, he said, we see humility as a virtue. we are more attracted to people who are both great and humble than we are to people who are great and have an arrogant ego. But he said that in ancient times, humility was not seen as a virtue. It was not seen as a positive character trait. He said that in ancient times, rather, humility was seen as a weakness, as evidence of being ill-informed and morally flawed. So what caused our culture to change from seeing humility as a flaw to seeing humility as a virtue? That's an interesting question. And as a professor of ancient history, John Dixon formed a research group, and they dug into the ancient records to find out the answer. And what did they find? They found out that a radical transformation took place in the first century, a humility revolution. They discovered that the basis of this change in thinking about humility was driven by the early Christians who had to grapple with Jesus' death by crucifixion. Since crucifixion was the most humiliating form of death, and Jesus died that way, and Jesus was God, then somehow Jesus' humility in allowing himself to be crucified must be part of his greatness. Jesus was born in humility. He taught about humility. He lived out humility. He died in humility. If you think that humility isn't important to God, then think again. If you find yourself admiring a Christian leader just because their job puts them up in front of a crowd or at the top of an org chart, then think again. Check to see if their lives reflect the humility of Christ. If you find yourself in a position of authority and you start to think that you are really something special, that you deserve the admiration of others, and that you really are entitled to the gifts your admirers send your way, then think again. Give yourself a thorough humility checkup. Jesus taught Saloma and his other followers that to be great means to serve, to die to self and to live for others, to willingly take on low, menial jobs and let the honor go to others. To not think that you are better than someone because you have a high status job, or conversely, not to think you are unimportant because you have a lower status job. Jesus taught that someone's position in a hierarchy has nothing to do with greatness, but servanthood and humility have everything to do with greatness. That leads me to our second truth. God's superstars aren't those who lust after the spotlight, but the ones who humbly serve without seeking applause. God's superstars aren't those who lust after the spotlight, but the ones who humbly serve without seeking applause. So are you consumed with trying to get attention for yourself? Are you always looking for opportunities to put yourself in the spotlight? And when you are serving, do you care more about getting applause and recognition than you do about the people you are serving? And who are you prone to admire because they happen to be in the spotlight rather than because they live a life that honors Jesus with their humble service? Let's move on to our last division, grief and good news. The next time we see Saloma in Scripture, her world has been turned upside down. Instead of traveling with Jesus, instead of hearing his teaching, instead of daydreaming about the day when Jesus would sit on the throne of David, now Saloma is watching her precious Lord hang on a Roman cross. We read in Matthew 27, verses 55 and 56. Many women there, watching from a distance, they'd followed Jesus from Galilee to care for his needs. Among them were Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James and Joseph, and the mother of Zebedee's sons, or Saloma. Her confusion and horror and fear, they must have been overwhelming. Saloma watches Jesus drink the cup of suffering. She watches him give his life as a ransom for many, and she doesn't turn away. She stays at the cross. Because Salome had been listening when Jesus taught the dance of kingdom greatness. She'd learned the two-step of forget prestige and serve others. She'd forgotten about prestige. She didn't care that her Lord had been labeled a criminal. She didn't care that the cross was the most humiliating form of execution. That wasn't important to her. She was totally focused on serving. She was there at the cross to continue to serve her Lord. Even in the most horrifying situation, she's there. Even though she's helpless to rescue him, she's there. She's serving him by being present with him in his darkest hour. And Salome experienced her own cup of suffering at the cross. She suffered as she watched her Jesus die. And it was risky for her to be there at the cross. The Pharisees were on the attack, and Salome was opening herself up to persecution for being identified as a follower of Jesus. But she's willing to take the risk and to bear the suffering to keep on serving. And Salome's service to Jesus didn't even stop after he had died. We read in Mark 16, starting in verse 1. When the Sabbath was over, Mary Magdalene, Mary the mother of James, and Salome bought spices so that it might go to anoint Jesus' body. Very early on the first day of the week, just after sunrise, they were on their way to the tomb, and they asked each other, "Who will roll the stone away from the entrance of the tomb?" Well, it seemed like an impossible situation for these women to be still serving Jesus. First, Jesus is dead. Second, the Pharisees are out to get Jesus' followers. And third, there's a very large stone in front of the tomb. But impossible odds don't deter Salome and the other women. They get up early and go to Jesus. They keep on with their ministry to care for Jesus, their Lord. They head to the tomb to show their love and gratitude in the only way they could, with spices to anoint his body, despite their grief and the danger of persecution and the very large stone. Do you get up early and go to Jesus, even when it seems like your world has been turned upside down and people are against you? Are you willing to keep on serving like Salome did, even when you come up against what seems like impossible odds and there are very large stones in front of you? Let's see what happens when they arrive at the tomb. Mark 16, verse 4. When they looked up, they saw that the stone, which was very large, had been rolled away. As they entered the tomb, they saw a young man dressed in white, a white robe, sitting on the right side, and they were alarmed. "Don't be alarmed," he said. "You are looking for Jesus, the Nazarene, who was crucified. He has risen. He's not here. See the place where they'd laid him? But go, tell the disciples and Peter. He is going ahead of you into Galilee. There you will see him, just as he told you." By doing the dance of kingdom greatness as Jesus had taught her, Salome found herself in the right place at the right time to experience a huge blessing. She got to be one of the first people to learn of Jesus' resurrection. She got to talk to an angel, and she was entrusted with the responsibility of sharing the good news with the disciples. How amazing and wonderful. That's what servanthood does. It puts us in places and situations where we can experience God's blessing. Those blessings might come totally unexpectedly, like they did for Salome at the tomb. And the blessings that we receive from Jesus, they might not look like success by the world's standards. We might not be blessed with wealth or health or power or comfort. But if we live the way that Jesus taught us to live, as servants and slaves, serving in humility for his name's sake, then we will experience the eternal blessing of seeing changed lives, of seeing God's power at work, of getting to be part of spreading the good news of Jesus to a lost and broken world. That brings me to our final truth. When I fully embrace my role as a servant, God can use me to spread his good news. When I fully embrace my role as a servant, God can use me to spread his good news. In what venue has he placed you to spread his good news? At work with a coworker? In a volunteer committee like the PTA or the Drama Boosters? Are you fully embracing your role as a servant of God in these venues? Or are you letting seemingly impossible odds and very large stones keep you from sharing the good news of Jesus with others? We can learn so much from looking at Saloma's example. I know I have. Like Saloma, we can start by taking our desires to Jesus in prayer, even if we're not sure that our desires are totally pure. And then we can listen for his answers, even if the answer is no or not now, and let him shape our will into a desire to seek his will. We need to practice the dance that Jesus taught Saloma so we can avoid the pitfalls of pride, to not be yertles that lord it over others, but instead to forget prestige and to serve others and to practice humility in whatever position God puts us. When we're tempted to be dazzled by the superstars who've been given roles that put them in the spotlight, we should remember that Jesus pointed to the servant and the slave as his superstars. And as Saloma taught us at the cross and the tomb, we're called to serve even when it's hard, trusting that Jesus will take care of moving away any very large stones that seem to block us, so that we will experience the blessing of being used by God to spread the good news that God loves you, that sin has been conquered, and that Jesus is alive. In closing, I want to share with you a little addition that I made to Dr. Seuss's story. I imagined this scene after King Yertle has fallen off his throne and is back in the turtle pond. Then the humble plain turtle, the turtle named Mac, befriended King Yertle and served him a snack. King Yertle was puzzled by Mac's snack on the tray. "I live in the mud now. My throne's gone away. So why does Mac serve me? How come he's so nice?" It made Yertle think. He thought once. He thought twice. Then he asked little Mac, "What's the deal? Are you crazy? You serve everyone. Has your brain gone all hazy?" Mac said, "I serve gladly. It's part of my dance. It's a two-step. I'll teach you if you'll take the chance. It's the dance that I learned from the one who loves you. Let me tell you his good news, then you can dance too." Thank you for attention.